From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was a fateful weekend in the Middle East. On Saturday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas resigned in frustration and failure. Yesterday, Yasser Arafat nominated a new prime minister, Ahmed Kouria. Israel launched a fierce but failed airstrike against the top spiritual leader of Hamas. Hamas promised merciless reprisal. Then Israel struck again Sunday night at a Hamas arsenal. Israel is tightening its border along the Gaza Strip. Arafat continues to rally strong public support. The roadmap now seems like a White House pipe dream. Tonight on Point, inside the Palestinian power shift. We begin in Israel with the latest reaction to the unfolding power shuffle. Harvey Morris is Jerusalem bureau chief for the Financial Times. I asked him whether Kouria will actually take the job.
It's almost certain he'll take the job. There are some of his critics in Parliament who say that, in a way, he sort of engineered the outcome of the meetings the other day that ended up with his predecessor resigning. So it seems as if he wants the job, but he's being a bit reluctant at the moment because he wants the guarantees to go with it.
But he is setting down these conditions at this point, guarantees. What's he asking for and from whom?
Well, he seems to be asking specifically for a commitment from the United States and the Europeans that they will help support this peace process by putting a bit more pressure on the Israelis to abide by their side of the roadmap. At the same time, he's asking the Israelis to ease up their military operations in the West Bank to give him a chance to make the thing succeed.
Harvey Morris, it was such a tumultuous weekend there in Israel. Can you walk us through how this unfolded? Mahmoud Abbas had been in the thick of things. Suddenly his resignation letter was there. And how did it all proceed?
There clearly was a power struggle between him and Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat is regarded by most Palestinians as the symbol of their struggle, and they were unhappy at the way in which the Americans and the Israelis had tried to marginalize him from the process. Now, Mahmoud Abbas had a task which the other day he described as almost impossible, because he was being asked to crack down on groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad without the resources to do so, and more importantly, as far as he was concerned, without any gesture from the Israelis that this was going to improve the lives of the Palestinians. He gave it what he saw as his best shot, and when he realized that he was being undermined internally, he obviously decided there was no way forward.
Tell us a little bit about Ahmed Kouria's history and whether or not it suggests he may have a better chance at success than Mahmoud Abbas.
The early reaction from the Israeli side was to say, well, here's a man who's very closely associated with Yasser Arafat. We don't want anybody who's going to be a tool of Yasser Arafat. We want somebody who's going to be his own man. The rhetoric has changed slightly in the last 24 hours. And the Israelis are recalling the fact that Kouria was one of the key negotiators at the beginning of the Oslo process, that he knows the Israelis well, that he's a skillful negotiator, and that maybe he can do a job that his predecessor was unable to do.
After everything we've seen in the last months, is there some note of optimism that a new face may be enough to change the dynamic?
That certainly isn't the impression that you get if you go to the Palestinian territory. I think the problem is that all this internal dispute within the Palestinian Authority is rather going over the heads of ordinary Palestinians who were very pleased when there was a ceasefire early in the summer. There were prospects of life getting better. Some of the restrictions they felt might be eased, and they were all in favor of the peace process. Now, I'm afraid, the attitude is a very pessimistic one, and a lot of people have given up on the roadmap as a formula for solving the problem.
But what does it mean to give up? If one gives up on the roadmap, what's the alternative?
Well, that's the key question, and we put that to a few dissident politicians in the West Bank today, and they were saying, look, the time for negotiations really has come to an end because we're a people under occupation. The Israelis aren't sincere in wanting to have peace. The Americans aren't sincere in wanting to push through this roadmap. without returning to violence, we have to start thinking about resisting the occupation in perhaps non-violent ways. This is something that I fear hasn't happened over the last 3 years, but it's an aspiration that some of the more reformist-minded people in the Palestinian territories now have.
So put yourself in Ahmed Khoury's shoes. What does he have to accomplish here to get off on a better footing than Mahmoud Abbas did?
I think when he's appealing for American help, he's sincere there. He wants some firmer statement from the Americans that they will watch this process day by day and make sure that whatever he does meets a parallel response from Israel. I think part of the reason the roadmap has fallen apart as it has is because it was a plan that was designed to run in parallel. In other words, the Palestinians would do something, at the same time the Israelis would do something. The reality is that neither side has really done very much at all. And the Israelis are now, you know, particularly after that horrible suicide bombing in Jerusalem last month, are very determined that they want to see action on the ground against militants before they're prepared to give anything else.
So perhaps the first challenge there is to see whether he can actually move against militants, terrorists among the Palestinians.
Well, that may be one way out. The trouble is that runs up against the skepticism of most Palestinians that they're going to get anything out of this process anyway. He faces really the same problems that his predecessor faced, and there doesn't seem to be any magic formula at the moment for changing that.
Harvey Morris, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Harvey Morris is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He spoke with me from Jerusalem. U.S.-backed Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas resigned this weekend, blaming both Yasser Arafat and Israel for undermining peace efforts. His move could force Israel, the United States, and Arafat to offer stronger support to the next Palestinian leader. Arafat's nominee, Ahmed Khoury, said he will not take the job unless he gets that support. But with Israel going for the Hamas juggler, Arafat continuing to flex his muscles, and neither Israelis nor Palestinians sticking to the roadmap, experts wonder whether Khoury can fare better than Abbas did and what will happen now to battered hopes for peace. Who do you blame for the failure of Mahmoud Abbas? Hamas? Arafat? Israel? Washington? Or Abbas himself? Can a new leader do what Abbas could not? Or will Arafat, as long as he lives, be the one in charge? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Silver Spring, Maryland, is Shibli Telhami, Anwar Sadat Professor of Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. He is author of The Stakes, America and the Middle East, and Identity and Foreign Policy in the Middle East. Good evening, and welcome back to On Point, Shibli Telhami.
Good evening to you.
And joining us from Tel Aviv is Barry Rubin, Director of the Global Research and International Affairs Center, a think tank based in Herzliya, Israel. He's also editor of the Middle East Review of International Affairs and co-author of the just-published Yasser Arafat, A Political Biography. Good evening and welcome, Barry Rubin.
Good evening or good morning.
Yes, very, very, very early morning there. And we thank you for staying up to be with us, Barry Rubin. Barry Rubin, it is so late there. Give us your take first here. How do you interpret the dance of succession over the weekend, the resignation over Mahmoud Abbas, Arafat's conflict with him on the way out, and the new man, Ahmed Khoury? Where are we headed?
Well, it's a broad question. First of all, I think the essential problem was that there never was a ceasefire because Mr. Arafat never stopped the attacks, and that there was never going to be any way that he was going to allow anyone to stop them, and that was the key problem. And he undermined Abu Mazen in a lot of ways, which we can list, and Abu Mazen finally resigned. He actually did exactly the same thing 10 years ago when he was supposed to conduct the negotiations with Israel and have a powerful role, and Arafat denied it to him. So now Arafat turns to Abu Al, and Abu Al is a very interesting figure.
And we need to say here that, of course, Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, and Abu Ala, Ahmed Khoury.
Right. I'm sorry.
Everybody's got these kind of noms de guerre or whatever they're called
right.
There, but we want to keep it straight.
I think they're generally easier for people to to remember, but yes, it is complicated, no doubt. Anyway, Abu Al is a very interesting figure. On the one hand, he is a technocrat historically. He was an economic official in the PLO. He was very much involved in putting together the Oslo Agreement. He was a key figure in the secret negotiations of early 2000. In fact, I would say that you could say that he, more than anyone else, convinced the U.S. and Israel that they might get somewhere in Camp David. Mm. And at Camp David, he went to the U.S. and Israeli delegation and said, I'd like to make peace, but Arafat won't let me. So that's his background. That's why it made sense for Arafat to appoint him, because he is somebody who is more moderate in some ways more moderate than Abu Mazen. On the other hand, however, Abu Mazen looked at himself as Arafat's equal. He was a man of importance in the movement. Abu Al really isn't. He has even less of a real political base than Abu Mazen. And he's behaved very badly, I think, in the last 3 months. He basically stabbed Abu Mazen in the back. After playing a central role in getting him through the parliament, he basically didn't do anything to help him. And he sort of stood by while this happened. So I think Arafat believes that on the one hand that he's someone who can appear as more moderate and flexible, but on the other hand will end up being more servile. But any idea that anybody is going to do anything, no matter what else happens, and Mr. Arafat wants to continue his war and to tell people in his organization, Fatah, to keep carrying on attacks and to keep financing them, it's not going to happen. And that doesn't mean that there aren't hopes. I mean, there are 5 or 6 points, I think, that we can look to with some hope. One of those is simply that the conflict has now gone on for 30 months, and clearly the costs are so high, and there's not going to be any Palestinian military victory.
Barry Rubin, hold it with that point for the moment, because I want to get into all of those points for hope. But I want to understand first what's gone on here. Shibli Talhami, what's your interpretation of the failure and departure of Mahmoud Abbas or Abu Mazen, and why this man, Ahmed Khoury or Abu Al Al, as his successor?
Well, let me start with the second part, which is a little bit easier to understand. I mean, frankly, I agree with Barry up to a point here. You know, Arafat did select Ahmed Khoury for a very specific reason, that is, he's acceptable. Frankly, the U.S. Has sent 2 names to Mr. Arafat prior to the appointment of Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas. And there were only 2 names, and that is Mahmoud Abbas and Ahmed Khoury.
So this was the only other option
on the
U.S. acceptable list.
Certainly that's from the point. If he wanted to keep the dialogue with the U.S., especially after a crisis that resulted in a U.S.-backed prime minister, this was really his only option. Second, I think Ahmed Khoury has some following within the Palestinian territories. While no man is particularly popular in the Palestinian areas, and certainly Arafat, despite his decline, still is more popular than anyone, actually in some ways, and here's where I disagree with Barry, Ahmed Khoury actually has a bit more legitimacy, certainly in the territories. For one thing, he's elected, and when he was elected, in fact, he received more votes than any other member of the Legislative Council.
And he's now the Speaker of the Palestinian Parliament.
And he's the Speaker. And so in that sense, while he may not be quite as influential historically within the movement and the Executive Committee of the PLO, he actually has some popular following. So he, in this environment, in fact, you know, he could help Arafat domestically in terms of addressing, you know, the resignation issue. So he does, Arafat anyway, scores in 2 ways here, both at home and abroad. But the question is, why did this happen?
And we're going to have to hold that question, if you'd be so kind, Shibli Talhami. We've got to take a short break here. Barry Rubin in Tel Aviv, Shibli Talhami in Silver Spring, Maryland. We'll be right back. We're talking tonight about the Palestinian power shuffle and the challenge to pull something, anything, out of the roadmap. You can join the conversation tonight. Who is to blame for the failure of Mahmoud Abbas? Hamas, Arafat, Israel, Washington, Abbas himself? And can a new Palestinian prime minister, can Ahmed Khoury, do what Abbas could not? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Palestinian power shuffle and the challenge to pull something, to pull anything out of the roadmap. You can join the conversation tonight. As long as Yasser Arafat lives, will he be the man really in charge on the Palestinian side? Is this struggle about Arafat or occupation or Hamas extremism? What fundamentally prevents a solution here? And what should Washington do now to push for peace? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight from Tel Aviv in Israel, Barry Rubin, co-author of the newly published Yasser Arafat, A Political Biography, and from the University of Maryland, Shibli Telhami. Earlier today, just a little while ago, I spoke with Michael Tarazi in Ramallah in the West Bank. He is legal advisor to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Until this weekend, he worked for then Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. I asked him whether Ahmed Koure could do what Mahmoud Abbas could not.
I think Ahmed Koure has been very wise. He understood and learned from Mahmoud Abbas that the problem that Mahmoud Abbas was facing had very little to do with internal Palestinian politics and instead had to do with the ongoing occupation. In fact, the position of most Palestinians worsened under the prime ministership of Mahmoud Abbas. And so therefore, Ahmed Koure has come out and said, look, I'm prepared to do this job, but for any Palestinian prime minister to succeed, I'm going to need some guarantees from the United States and the Europeans that they will do everything they can to make sure Israel performs its obligation.
But what about this issue of taking control of the security situation in the West Bank, in the Gaza Strip? Can any Palestinian prime minister accomplish that?
Not through military means alone, because this is not a military conflict. It's a political conflict. I mean, if we analyze this dispassionately for a moment, I mean, Israel has the largest army in the Middle East. It has F-16s, Apache helicopter gunships, billions of dollars from the Americans every year. And they're not able to provide themselves with security. That's because one needs to address political problems using political measures. And this is the one thing Israel has refused to do.
But Michael Tarazi, if I may, you describe it as a political conflict, and clearly there's a huge element of that. But there are obviously players here who also see it as a military conflict of sorts, who see violence as a key tool in this conflict.
That's exactly right. There are people on both sides. On the Palestinian side, you have extremist groups like Hamas and Jihad. On the Israeli side, you have the Israeli government under the leadership of Sharon, who see violence as a mechanism and as an end unto itself. But that does not end the violence, of course, and this is what we're trying to fight against, those two extremist elements. The only way to do that is to address the political measures underneath all of that violence. I mean, the violence is a symptom. The underlying disease, of course, is the occupation, and that's why Ahmed Koure has announced today that in order for him to succeed, he's going to make sure that those political measures are going to take place.
If there should be some movement on that political front, even then, do you see a way that he could take control of the security situation, that he could pull the teeth of militants who would use violence to once again incite everything?
Absolutely, and this has historically been the case. I mean, for example, in 1996, the Palestinian Authority was able to crack down very effectively against Hamas and Jihad, and the reason they were able to do so was, first, they actually had an infrastructure. Right now, the Palestinians don't have a security infrastructure. Israel systematically destroyed it over the last 3 years. However, the more important reason was because the Palestinian people themselves supported such a crackdown. And the reason they supported it in 1996 was because they had believed in the process, they thought the process was working, and they wanted to make sure that no one derailed that process. Right now, most Palestinians, including myself, don't believe the process is working, don't believe that Israel has any intention of ever ending its occupation and allowing the Palestinians to live in the same freedom that Israelis demand to live in themselves.
And you put an awful lot of it back in the laps of Washington and the United States. Michael Tarazi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Tarazi in Ramallah in the West Bank. I spoke with him earlier. He's a spokesman and legal advisor for the PLO. We're joined tonight by Barry Rubin in Tel Aviv and Shibli Telhami, the University of Maryland. Barry Rubin, you hear there Michael Tarazi's analysis. He says...
No, I didn't hear his analysis. I actually heard his propaganda.
Well, as you'll have it, but you heard his message, and his message there being violence is a symptom, occupation is the disease. How do you interpret this?
I interpret it as follows. In the year 2000, Yasser Arafat was offered peace at Camp David and the Clinton plan. He turned it down. Instead, he decided to launch a war on Israel. He thought he would win that war by two means. First of all, as he's done since the 1960s, using terrorism to get Israel to make unilateral concessions. Secondly of all, to put his people in the position of being victims, i.e. to make them suffer so that he could get international sympathy. After 30 months and 3,000 people killed, to absolutely no useful purpose whatsoever, he wants to continue with this policy rather than make peace. The reason there's violence is because Mr. Arafat wants to use violence. There was never any ceasefire. The number of attacks on Israel went down from about 40 to 20. He was giving money to groups. He was ordering groups. He was carrying out incitement in the media undercover. That's why there's violence. And he brought an end to the violence in 1996 because he had the incentive to do so. At that time, we don't have time to go into all the details, he arrested 2,000 to 3,000 Hamas people. This time he hasn't arrested a single person. Part of the deal was, for example, that Arafat agreed that he was going to dismantle and disarm the groups, but he didn't do that, nothing short of it. He agreed to send a number of terrorists who had taken refuge in his compound to Jericho where they would keep quiet. They decided they didn't want to go, so he let them stay there. This is ridiculous, so this is a farce.
Ray Rubin, stand by. I want to get Shibley Talhami's response here as well. Shibley Talhami, what do you make of the underlying dynamic here? Barry Rubin says Yasser Arafat has built this 30-month-long campaign on the suffering of the Palestinians, and he's in suggesting he's happy for that to go on as a means.
Well, first of all, let's go back to why Abu Mazen resigned, okay,
and take it
from there. No question that he resigned in part because of the power struggle with Arafat. Arafat is asserting himself. Clearly, that's an issue, and he's exercising his power. And he made a point, and in a way, he won this confrontation. But the reason why Arafat could do that, the reason why he could do it and succeed, the reason why Abu Mazen failed ultimately was not Arafat and the power struggle. That's a sideshow, an important one. It ultimately brought about his demise. But the fact is that Mahmoud Abbas could never get popular support. Why? Because ultimately, the roadmap so far has delivered little of tangible benefit to the vast majority of the Palestinians, and they are under very difficult, painful condition. And we can go to blame as to why and what happened after Camp David and all that whole story, where there is more than one narrative. What Barry has stated is one narrative, but there are a lot of different sides as to what happened. But in any case, the bottom line is there is no prime minister. Let's say Arafat disappears from the scene today. What would ultimately happen? It doesn't matter who's going to be on top. Whoever is going to be on top is going to have to ultimately deliver, because the fight, they're going to have to come. Clearly, there can be no military and certainly no terrorist operations from Palestinian areas against innocent civilians. No authority should accept any other group within its boundaries.
You're saying if those go on, there won't be peace, you're saying?
Well, in order to succeed, though, you see, you've got you need two things. One is powerful enough security services, and two, you need to have public opinion on your side.
Mm-hmm.
And the Palestinian Authority today, no matter who is the prime minister, whether it's Ahmed Khurair or it's Mahmoud Abbas, you're going to have no capacity to deliver without the help of Israel, without the help of the international community, let alone the power struggle within the Palestinian.
So are you saying that Ahmed Khorei is going to be in precisely the same position that Mahmoud Abbas was? You indicated earlier he has a little more political sway. Is it enough to make a difference on the Palestinian front?
I do not think so. I think the reality of it is the roadmap is truly in trouble right now, and no question about it. It's not so much a function of the crisis of prime minister. It's just because it was, regardless, and it will be. And I think there should be a timeout, because I think there's a structural problem in the roadmap. And the structural problem is, A, there's no trust on both sides. Therefore, they're hostage to events and to militants. And two, whatever Party A does to succeed at step one is going to undermine its leverage to negotiate in the more important step two, because they don't know what the final outcome is going to be. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, there is no incentive for the parties to move forward in this environment. So you really do need new ideas on the horizon, and they're not likely to come from within Israel and the Palestinian areas.
And yet no one wants to go back to all-out bloodshed here. Barry Rubin, Shibli Talhami, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, D.C., Edward Walker. He's president of the Middle East Institute. He was former ambassador to Israel, the Arab Republic, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. Good evening and welcome, Ned Walker.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. Thanks for joining us. It's been put on the table here tonight that as long as Arafat is in power, there will never be peace. Alternatively, on the table, that even if Arafat goes under current conditions, there won't be peace that way either. How do you read the Arafat factor? Mahmoud Abbas is gone. Arafat's still there. How does he play out now?
Well, the fact is that Arafat worked very hard to get rid of Mahmoud Abbas. And he was, I think, concerned about his stature, his authority, and so on. Abu Mazen, or Mahmoud Abbas, was trying to solidify the security services under his control, which would be necessary if you wanted to actually do something about terrorism. And Arafat didn't accept that. And what you saw was a consistent pattern of Arafat undermining Abu Mazen and seeking to expel him.
And what is the meaning of that? Does it mean that Yasser Arafat did not want the roadmap to succeed?
It means that Yasser Arafat did not want anybody else to run the Palestinian lives. And he has an enormous desire to be the savior, the overall figure in charge of the Palestinians. And he certainly was an incredible a leader in the sense of the Palestinians coming from nothing to becoming an international force, but he's not the person that could lead them to a state and to a future.
I don't know how this would happen, but let's say Arafat were out of the picture. There's talk of expulsion. There's certainly been a lot of efforts to isolate him. Shibli Talhami says, even take Yasser Arafat out of the picture, and a successor, another prime minister, will not be able to rally popular Palestinian support if conditions on the ground don't change. Do you agree, or might there be some room here for an Ahmed Kore unburdened by Yasser Arafat?
Well, I think that if Arafat were to actually walk away from it, and if you were to bring the security forces under one person's control, and if you were to reinforce the Minister of Finance instead of trashing his headquarters the way the Arafat people did, you might start to get a great deal lot more support from the United States, from the Europeans, and so on, for the new prime minister. And they might be able to convince Prime Minister Sharon to start giving something that would make the new prime minister come out much better in the eyes of his people.
Barry Rubin, we've got several, at least two narratives going here, views of what's going on. But on this Arafat theme, what's your thought? Is he going anywhere? There's talk of expulsion, but then both Colin Powell and people within Israel say that wouldn't make things any better. Is he going to continue simply to be a core factor?
I think there are two basic points that one has to make about, three basic points that one has to make about Yasser Arafat. One of them is that he's unwilling to make a real peace because he still hopes to get everything, to destroy Israel, and he wants to, he's ready to keep the conflict going and only end it if it leaves the door open to that, and that makes peace impossible. The second principle is that he's going to remain the leader of the Palestinians as long as he lives. But remember, we are talking about a man who just celebrated his 74th birthday. And while sometimes the remarks on his health is not as bad as some people say, but it's not so great. So I would suggest that what's happened is this, that while the attempt to replace Yasser Arafat may have failed, the struggle to succeed him has now begun. In other words, everyone is saying, what's going to come after? Maybe me. Who should I support? The third principle about Yasser Arafat that we talk about a lot in our book, Yasser Arafat, A Political Biography, published this week by Oxford University Press, is that Mr. Arafat is now in the fourth cycle of his life, and his inability to learn from his experience is remarkable. In Jordan between 1967 and 71, in Lebanon between 1971 and 82, 83, in Tunis from 83 to 93, and now in the West Bank and Gaza, 94 to the present, he's done the same thing. And each time he's treated his host so badly, has not kept his commitments, he's used violence and so on, that he's ended up wrecking his situation. So this, I think what we have to ask is this, in the context of a succession struggle, in the context of the fact that people, that many or most people now agree more than ever before about what the solution is, which is a two-state solution with two countries living in peace side by side, we have to see how we can move in that direction, even though we know we're not going to get a resolution in the next 12 months. But that doesn't mean that, you know, one doesn't try to move in that direction.
Shibli Tilhami, give us your interpretation on Arafat here. You say take him out of the picture and the dynamic remains the same. And yet, of course, over time, a leader does have a kind of chemistry with the people. If it were, let's say, the succession ultimately goes to Ahmed Korey, might that change the tenor in such a way that could actually flip circumstances?
First of all, I don't think the dynamics remain the same when you change a leader. I think leaders matter, and I think the dynamics could change one way or the other. I said what the bottom line would be is any new leader is going to have a problem as long as things on the ground don't change. Yeah. I mean, that's the problem, is delivery. But I do think that, you know, the issue of could there be a better leader? I think there could be a better leader for sure among Palestinians. I also think that there could be better leaders in Israel as well. I think that's something that one hopes for. But the reality of it is the fact that one doesn't like a leader doesn't give one a right to go to change them. And that's the problem that we face. I mean, there's one thing to say that I wish the Palestinians had a different leader.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing to say, I'm not going to deal with this issue at all. I personally think that despite all of his shortcomings, and Arafat clearly wants to be, as Ned said, the central figure for the Palestinians. He sees himself as a historical figure. He doesn't want anyone to overshadow him. No doubt about that. And Abu Mazen was getting close to that. But the bottom line is, I don't buy the argument that all that he's striving for is to see a destruction. I think that he has to be a total fool, not just an incompetent leader, but a total fool to think that that's within his reach. I think if you look at his the history, his struggle, what he represented as a leader of what was a secular national movement that he built through the PLO and then came so close to bringing about a Palestinian national homeland, his failure in this environment would really lead not only to his own personal failure, but the failure of his entire project, because the likely outcome will be, in fact, some form of Islamist movement that would take his place within the Palestinian areas.
Shibli Tilhami, stand by. We have to take a short break here. We'll get right back to that thought. Shibli Tilhami, Barry Rubin, Ambassador Ned Walker, stand by. We're talking about the Palestinian power shuffle. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Palestinian power shuffle and the struggle to pull something, anything, out of the roadmap. You can join the conversation tonight. Can any Palestinian leader succeed in this situation? How? And what's Israel's culpability here? What is the Palestinians' culpability? What's Washington's? Is there hope here? What is it? Where is it? My guest tonight, former Ambassador Ned Walker, now president of the Middle East Institute, was ambassador to Israel, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. Also with us from Tel Aviv in Israel, Barry Rubin, Director of Global Research and International Affairs at the center there and author of the new book, Yasser Arafat, A Political Biography, and Shibli Tilhami, Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland. Shibli Tilhami, you were in the middle of a point, and I want to get right back to it, but I've had so many callers waiting to come on. Let me turn to them first, if you'd be so kind. Alan is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've enjoyed the conversation. On the subject of the roadmap and culpability,
yeah.
I wanted to make the point that the roadmap couldn't do anything but fail. The way it was set up, and I put the blame on the European Union and the United States for their own international geopolitical reasons, they needed to get the Palestinian-Israeli issue off the table. And as a result, they created an artificial window dressing, cosmetic type of process that has no chance to succeed.
But nothing else has succeeded, Alon, and everybody wants to see a solution here. They want to see two-state solution by the year 2005. Why not push for that? Well, why not try to cut the knot?
Well, first of all, putting any time limits on such a difficult issue that's not 3 years in the making or a decade in the making, but is 100 years in the making, is unrealistic. The second part is that you really do need it is still the same as always, a security for land type of deal. Without security, there's no land. And as a result of that, Mahmoud Abbas was trying to avoid a civil war, but the truth is there's no avoiding it.
Within the Palestinian community, you're saying?
Within the Palestinian community, there are two factions. Those that just want to live their lives in a Palestinian state and be left alone, and those who want to seek havoc and destruction and kill as many Jews as possible.
And so you're saying that they've got to have at it, along we've got the perspective. Ned Walker, join us here. We've heard this, that it's got to be resolved inside the Palestinian community first, and yet they live in an awful kind of pressure cooker. How do you interpret?
Well, there's no question that you can't have peace unless you can resolve this particular question that Alon has raised. You can't have peace with people who want to destroy you. I mean, ultimately, they have to either come to accept that they are going to be a political factor or they have to be suppressed. And so I agree that that particular problem does require the Palestinians to face themselves, but it can't be done alone. They can't face it when they're under constant pressure. They can't face it when everybody in the Palestinian community is constantly being put under the pressure of going through checkpoints of not being able to have an economic life,
mm-hmm.
No children going to school, this kind of thing. So it's got to be a combination that people have to work together to make this thing work.
So, and Shibli Tilhami, you were about to come to this point, I think, but where responsibility yep. lies for what hasn't worked so far on the roadmap? Alon said it was designed not to work.
Well, I think it wasn't designed not to work, but he was right on one thing. I don't think it was, in essence, designed with the idea that it was going to be an implementable thing. It was done on the eve of the war,
mm-hmm.
and frankly, it was in a way to do something in the meanwhile, to put ideas together that were acceptable to a large number of people, at a time when there was a lot of demand to do something on the Middle East prior to the Iraq War.
You're agreeing it was window dressing then?
I don't think it was just window dressing, but I think it was not in a way designed to be optimally implementable. And I think that right after it was clear that the only way this thing could work was if the U.S. held hand with iron fists every step of the way, because there was so little trust, there was so many things that would have to work for it to be implemented.
And holding hands with all parties with an iron fist.
Absolutely,
here.
Absolutely, with both sides, with all sides, I should say, including with the Arab countries and everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But so in a way, there is a structural flaw in the way this is designed, and obviously it's hard to overcome. But it's if you look at the other issue of what would happen within the Palestinian community, I think every responsible Palestinian leader that recognizes that ultimately, there can only be one authority. There can't be more.
Is it going to take a civil war to achieve that?
And that's the real question. And I think that, does it require a civil war? Well, if it does, certainly they're not in a position to win it. That is, the Palestinian Authority is not.
You mean Hamas would win it?
Well, they would stand a better chance right now of at least getting public opinion in this environment, because mm-hmm. they don't know for what end the civil war has taken place, to the extent that they don't know if there is going to be a state that would be along what they have, what they want.
Acceptable,
second, the
yep.
security forces are not yet strong enough. So the real issue is, at what point does that come, if it was going to come at all?
So you have to create circumstances where the parties pushing for peace might be the winners there. Sean's calling from Dracut, Massachusetts. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Great, thanks
for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I'm interested in this whole issue. I agree that the roadmap was really, it was window dressing. The Bush administration was so detached from the Palestinian-Israeli conflict from its inauguration.
So where does responsibility really lie here? You're saying a bad plan from Washington?
With Mahmoud Abbas stepping down
in the
current situation?
Yeah.
I think the Sharon regime hasn't shown good faith. It's not backing off on the settlements. It's not stopping the wall being built. Everything it's done has sort of instigated the Palestinians to do exactly what Sharon wants them to do, which is to remain violent because the Israeli government has the military force to suppress it. And I just want to add, Mr. Rubin had pointed out that Arafat wants to destroy the Israelis. He's come out many times and publicly stated his position, which is he wants the 68 borders recognized. There's a framework for the peace process. The final status has to be talked about. Water has to be talked about. The settlements, the repatriation, the right of return for all refugees. There is a framework. The Bush administration didn't need to set up a new one. It needed to actually apply the conditions. It applies to other nations regarding military aid and Sharon's use of it.
Sean, we've got the picture. Let me put it to Barry Rubin. Barry, Sean, on balance, lays this failure of Abbas at the feet of Israel and paints Arafat as less entrenched than you would have it.
I don't want to put words in his mouth. That doesn't like George Bush either. But look, the truth, the fact is this, that there were two serious offers in the year 2000. Mr. Arafat rejected them, and he went to war. People in Israel want to have a Palestinian state living in peace. They don't want to encourage Palestinians to attack them so they'll blow up our children. I mean, this is not the reality of the situation. If Mr. Arafat had moved toward peace in 2000, 3,000 people would be alive today. There'd be no violence. There'd be no roadblocks. Every Palestinian who was killed, except the suicide bombers, was killed fighting over land that Barak had already ceded. And if you want to know who's responsible for the violence, it's very simple. If the Palestinians stopped attacking Israel, there'd be no roadblocks, there'd be no fence, there'd be no Israeli attacks. But if Israel did nothing, in fact, we saw this in the earlier part of the roadmap, the Palestinian attacks would in fact continue. That's what's going on here. Now, actually, it is a very difficult conflict, but it's not really all that difficult to resolve this. If Mr. Arafat had used the power he had to stop the attacks and stop the fighting, then, in fact, the violence would have ended, serious negotiations would have started, and if Mr. Sharon is as horrible as some people are saying he is, then Israel would be blamed and would lose out.
I want to turn to Ned Walker just in a little bit. I've got left here, Barry Rubin, if you'd be kind enough. Ned Walker, what should we be watching for as Ahmed Kore presumably steps into this role as signifiers of where this might be headed?
All right, one thing, whether he has any independence from Arafat. He doesn't, then I think he's in a serious problem. Second of all, what is this administration going to do? Are they going to recognize him? Are they going to accept this? I have my doubts, unless he can demonstrate that he is independent of Arafat. Hmm. And third, what does Sharon do? Is Sharon going to continue to, or is he going to give a break to allow Ahmed Kore time to establish himself? Mm-hmm. Or are they going to continue to fight and keep the pressure on? That's going to have a lot to do with it.
Well, much to watch, but our time is up at this point. Edward Walker, former ambassador to Israel, Egypt, and the UAR, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
You.
And Shibli Tilhami, Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Barry Rubin, who stayed up so late, we're very grateful to you. Thanks so much for your time. Barry Rubin is Director of Global Research and International Affairs Center, a think tank based in Herzliya, Israel. He's co-author of the new book, Yasser Arafat, A Political Biography. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a message of tolerance from the Dalai Lama. This is On Point. In a time of plenty of religious conflict, the Dalai Lama is touring the United States this week with a message of religious tolerance. Yesterday, on a stop in Bloomington, Indiana, the Tibetan Buddhist leader said, "All the major religious traditions of the world carry the same potential and capacity to serve humanity." Here is an excerpt of the Dalai Lama's address.
Once we accept religion, then we should be very serious about one's own religion. Should implement all these sort of teaching like love, forgiveness, contentment, self-discipline. These should be in our sort of daily life. Therefore, when we come across some problems, some difficulties, including sort of facing enemies, then during that moment, spirit of forgiveness must be there. Self-discipline does not mean some kind of burden or some kind of rule imposed. No. Self-discipline means protection of one's own long-term or greater interest. Like, you see, taking care of one's own body, one's own health. That is the self-discipline. So discipline must come from within, voluntarily. Then that be more effective. Sometimes I myself also not very sort of fully implemented these things, but I'm trying. So similarly, our brother sisters here, once you believe certain sort of tradition, certain religion, they should be very sincere, very serious. It's not sufficient. Just attend Sunday sort of prayer, and then outside nothing there. That's not sufficient. And then another thing, once we sincerely implement one's own teaching, then eventually you gain more inner experiences. You will realize the value of one's own teaching. Through that way, you also can see the value of other tradition. So that I would like to say to you, if you agree, then please practice. Yeah. If you do not agree, then forget it. Then those people who have no particular religious belief, that's okay. There's no problem. But I think one thing, anyone who want happy life, successful life, then I think the key factor for that is warm heart. That's very essential. Whether non-believer or believer, I think the more compassionate feeling there, you will be more happier. Your health may be better. Even if you got some illness, it cure more rapidly. If hatred, negative emotion keeps here, then your day-to-day life become more difficult. Even in your sleep, more disturbances. Even in your dream, more nightmare. So the warm heart automatically develop open mind.
Tibetan Buddhist leader the Dalai Lama speaking yesterday at the consecration of a new interfaith temple outside Bloomington, Indiana. It was his second stop on a 5-city U.S. tour that will take him to Washington, Boston, and New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.